Hey, it's Elle.
And M.
And you're listening to the Baby Project Podcast.
In this podcast, we will discuss our journeys as well as other warriors going through the ups and downs of infertility.
There's ups?
Yes, there's ups.
Okay. As a reminder, be kind to yourself and skip as needed. We know some topics may be triggering. Let's get talking.
Hey everyone, and we are finally back for another season. We are so pumped, but more so because we have a very special guest joining us today. This special guest of ours is a physiotherapist and was for quite some time, but has stopped to pursue her baby-making journey. When she is not whipping up a batch of her delicious bliss balls, you can find her enjoying her time outside in nature or coastal walks with her partner. Joining us from Melbourne, Australia, we have Joanna on our podcast today.
Welcome, Joanna. Thank you so much for being on the Baby Project Podcast with us today.
Yay, welcome.
Thank you for having me. It's quite exciting, actually. It's I've listened to a few of your podcasts, so it's nice to be on the talking side, not the listening side.
It's different, right? It's therapeutic when you're able to tell your story as well.
Definitely.
I will say that since we've joined Instagram back in the, I think it was like spring coming into summer, we followed you and I have like so closely watched all of your stories and your page and been like silently cheering, as we all do in the community, mm-hmm. right? But I've been like silently cheering you on and it's been so interesting and lovely to, I came in at sort of the tail end, right? Just these last few months of your journey. Okay. Which has yes. been, you know, a long thing, which we'll get into, but I feel like I jumped in right at like the good parts.
You didn't see all the heartache of the last 2 years, but that's okay.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So Joanna, do you want to kind of tell us a little bit of, you know, where the magic started, how you met your partner and your love story?
Well, it's not the typical love story as I've heard a lot of people talk about. I met Nick probably at the gym, at a local gym, 13, 14 years ago. I think it was lust at first sight for me, more so for him. And since then, we've had one of those really roller coaster, possibly toxic relationships where we saw each other, didn't see each other. I did my own thing. He did his own thing. And but we always sort of reconnected, which was, I don't know, meant to be, written in the stars.
Yeah.
Fast forward to probably 2017-18, I think, on a New Year's Day, I remember saying to him, and he still remembers this very clearly, it was in the morning, I think I was getting changed to activewear, and I said to him, I am turning 43 this year. I want to have a baby. It can either be with your sperm or some random stranger, so it's your choice. And luckily he made the right decision and chose to have his sperm in me. And fast forward to now, happy endings. So yes, it's not the typical love story, but it's a very beautiful love story in its own way. And I think and we often do this, we look back and, you know, given our story, which we'll get into, you know, had we gotten together 8 years ago, gotten married, we feel that we would probably be divorced right now. A lot of our friends, you know, got together early, like they all have kids and they're all getting divorced. So we feel very strongly, although possibly the best baby making years of our lives, you know, passed us by, our relationship now would, you know, is strong and it, you know, we will be together for the rest of our lives. So yeah, I strongly believe, although I wish we got together years ago, the timing wasn't there.
Sometimes things just unfold as they should. Although we might not agree with the timeline, we don't agree mm-hmm. with the way that things are unfolding, or it feels really uncomfortable as it's happening. But like you said, when you look back, it's like, shit, that was kind of, that it unfolded had to the happen. Way. Yeah.
So I guess while you were talking to him, baby and family planning didn't come up at all, or did it? Or was it at that point when you said, hey, listen, I'm ready to have a baby? That was when you started seriously talking about family planning.
I guess yes and no. I guess throughout the years, he probably knew I wanted a family, but he wasn't ready. So it wasn't an open conversation.
Mm-hmm.
So when it was, you know, push came to shove kind of thing, then he had to really sit and think about it
mm-hmm.
at the time when I put him on the spot. But a little bit, I'll go back a little bit. We actually did fell pregnant when I was 40. So it was with his baby, but unfortunately I had to terminate that pregnancy, which was really heartbreaking. I was actually on Roaccutane. I don't know whether you know that drug. It's a dermatologist prescriber. It's a high potency vitamin A. So it's for acne, and vitamin A is highly toxic. So it was unfortunate. I was on that drug for acne at that stage, and I was only on it for I think a month, but you know, I was advised no baby would survive and it would be highly disabled, deformed. So the medical advice was to terminate. So that was very unfortunate at the time.
Oh my goodness.
So, but you know, I did fall pregnant when I was 40. So that gave me a bit of hope in its own really weird way.
Did you ever have the biological clock start kind of ticking in your ear as the years are sort of rolling around, you know, when people ask those lovely questions? Oh, 100%. Have kids.
Yeah.
1,000%. I actually froze my eggs. I can't remember exactly now. I think when I was 38 or 37, that is another story in itself. The clinic that I chose, unfortunately, I feel that they stuff things up or they stuff the protocol up, because I collected one egg. So for an egg collection at 37, when my AMH was sky high, I felt it was a mistake. And the specialist at the time goes, oh no, we can, you know, rejig your protocol. I can do this, I can do that. And at the time it's $12,500. Just $12,500. You don't get any rebate. It's that. So I'm like, and I don't really have a few more chunks of $12,000 to give you. You know, she was saying, let's do a few cycles. I'm like, I don't have $70,000 to, you know, just try this thing, when clearly something went wrong when there was follicles on the scan and, you know, you collected one egg.
Mm-hmm.
So I was very disappointed. Again, in hindsight, I wish I'd gone back and do more cycles, but I didn't. So at the age of 37, I actually thought that my fertility was, excuse the French, fucked. Yeah, that my fertility was gone at 37. So then to fall pregnant at 40, that gave me a bit of hope. So yeah, that's a little backstory there. So yes, clock was always ticking. I had the egg freezing journey, which wasn't very successful. It was always on my mind, and it was never a question for me to have a family, just the timing wasn't there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So let's kind of jump into the the good bits. Tell us about your, you know, fertility journey and where you are now.
I don't even know whether you've got enough time. Like, where do we start? I'll try to make it short and sweet. So fast forward, given to, you know, it has to be your sperm or a random stranger's sperm. We kind of never tried naturally, because my clock was ticking and I thought, you know, I'm just going to make an appointment with a specialist straight away. So at the time, you know, it was a 3-4 month wait. So I did it anyway, like made the appointment. I had one in April, I think. And we were ticking along and I said to him, well, I've got this appointment with, you know, a specialist. Let's go. So I mean, he came along. So that was pretty much the start of my IVF journey, or Nick and I's IVF journey. I think April 2019, I went with a clinic that did my egg freezing. Melbourne IVF is a big conglomerate in Australia, or Melbourne. So it's a big company, it's got lots of specialists. So I mean, you can choose a specialist. So at the time I chose one that was recommended, and she's, you know, very highly recommended here and spoken well of. And I saw her, I did 3 cycles with her and 4 transfers, and something wasn't right. I wasn't falling pregnant. And I just felt that she was just doing the same thing over and over again, expecting a different result. It was doing the same protocol, same medication, and she wouldn't test me for a few tests I requested. So at that stage, I joined Facebook forums, investigated, you know, knew the lingo, new tests I should be having. So I requested immune protocols and immune testing, and she was one of those specialists who didn't believe in natural killer cells, didn't believe in doing a hysteroscopy, you know, until I had 5-6 failed transfers. So that frustrated me. And I just thought that was a bit negligent, or whatever you want to call it. Mm-hmm. So we left that clinic. I went with another clinic, and I'm so happy I swapped. I actually did, so that was 3 cycles and 4 transfers. My next clinic, I did 7 cycles and probably another 7 or 8 transfers. Lynn Burmeister, my specialist, she actually did get me pregnant, but I lost that baby in February. So after a very long journey, she did get me pregnant at 44, but unfortunately we lost that baby. So fast forward again to the next few months, Nick and I decided to go down the donor process, because at that stage I was going to be turning 45, and most specialists in Australia had that cutoff. 45 is the last, you know, the latest age they'll do, you know, a stem cycle with your own eggs. Lynn, God bless her soul, she's amazing. She would have done another cycle for me. And after I lost my baby, I had to wait for my period to come back, which probably took 2 to 3 months. Wow. She said, yep, I'll do another cycle for you, even though you're past 45. If you need closure, if you need, you know, just one last hurrah, see what happens. If you get nothing, you get nothing. If you get something, you get something. In the background of that, I was doing a lot of research. I reopened the donor story. I had researched that the year before, so I knew about it. I had contacts, but I closed that book actually due to COVID, because we couldn't travel. And then because of COVID, because we're stuck in Australia, I continued the cycles with Lynn, and then we fell pregnant. So after losing my baby in February, I reopened that story. And although I did want to do one last cycle, when I discovered I could actually possibly fly overseas and be pregnant again by the end of 2021, a switch just flicked. I'm like, we're doing this. I'm ready. That's it. You know, say goodbye to my genetics. I'm ready to let go. I'm ready to do this. So again, fast forward to trying to get all the logistical documentation to travel in the midst of COVID and a pandemic and a lockdown. We managed to do it. We flew to Malaysia and we had a very successful donor cycle. I am cutting out a lot of the story, but in a little nutshell, that's our story. A lot of people have asked me why I chose Malaysia. I actually searched the world for the particular donor eggs I wanted. If I had to give up my genetics, I wanted some of my heritage in there. So I specifically wanted Asian eggs, and they're very hard to come by. They're very hard to come by. And in the US particularly, it's a premium. Like, you're paying a premium price for donor eggs.
What?
I don't know why, but yes.
It's maybe because it's so rare, is it?
Possibly.
Maybe? I don't know.
Not necessarily so in the US.
Oh, okay.
Because there are a lot of Asians in the US, but okay. It comes with a premium price.
Wow.
And other common clinics that a lot of my friends have gone to, like Greece and South Africa, it's very common. Again, reached out to many clinics there, and they're really no Asian eggs. So another friend who actually lives in America, I've been speaking to her and I reconnected with her, and she had used a clinic in Malaysia, which I then researched, and you know, it was very highly respected. So I reached out to Alpha Fertility in Malaysia, and they were so easy to deal with, so easy to deal with. So everything, you know, from that first email I sent to them, it just went so smoothly, well, as smoothly as you can in COVID. But they just made it so easy. So, you know, given that we had to get travel exemptions from Australia, travel exemptions from Malaysia to enter the country, really everything fell into place. I feel very lucky looking back at what Nick and I did in terms of how we did it, the timing, the cycle, the donor cycle, the transfer. It, like, everything fell into place, thank God.
Mm-hmm. You just took us on like a roller coaster ride.
I don't even know where to start.
I think too, like, we're so used to living like our story, we're so used to, because you know it's on loop in our mind because we have it so compartmentalized so quickly, but throughout that time I can only imagine how much pain you've went through and how difficult this process has been. And you know, even just the cycles, like my eyes could have just popped out of my head when you said that you did, was it 3 or 4 with the first one and 7 with the next one? Yeah. I'm like, shit, yeah, I did 2 and I was done.
Yeah.
No.
I did 7 back to back because I did 3 with that first clinic. And then I saw Lynn and we almost did another 4 back to back before sort of before Christmas. And then I had to have a Christmas break and then COVID. And then then the next few cycles were a bit more, you know, sparsely in between. But yeah, I did actually 7 back to back. And yeah. It wasn't a nice time. It wasn't actually a nice time at all. Yeah, I just, you know how it feels when you're just pumped full of hormones and you feel shit and you've got acne everywhere and you're bloated and
I feel like did you not sort of like, you just didn't feel yourself for so long, because you feel like you're kind of like another, when you're cycling, right, when you're doing your stims, you just feel like you're in another world for that set of time, because your goal is just to kind of get to egg retrieval. So I feel like doing it back to back so many times, you just, it's like you're in another world, you know, and you wake up after 6 months or 7 months like, where the hell have I been?
Yeah.
exactly. I think I had the pressure of time at the whole, you know, I'm 43 turning 44. So I literally had the pressure of, I have no time behind me. So I have to get this done. So that was another driving factor in why I did what I did.
Which is horrible. I also put that pressure like on myself as well. That pressure is horrible to feel like you feel like your options are so limited, because you're like, okay, what's the shortest way to get me to my goal? What's the fastest thing I need to do this? Cause time is chasing me. So I wanted to ask like that about the cycles, were they, cause then you said you did transfers as well. So were they successful, or were some successful and some not?
No. So I never, you know how you get the HCG, you might get like a chemical pregnancy, you might get 20 on beta or 40. Mine was always like 0. It's like literally nothing happened. You know, I did all the pee on the sticks. I was that psycho person at the start who peed on the stick, but I learned very quickly not to do that, because it just gives you a little, you know, your head just goes crazy. Mm-hmm. When you don't see those 2 lines on day 5 or 6. So, but yeah, no, there were never chemicals. There were literally, you know, you're not pregnant. So I was then able to, being that psycho person type A that I was, go back to back. Okay, not pregnant, stop progesterone, let's get my period, let's get the next cycle going. So that's how I could do the back to back to back. Mm-hmm. I was transferring fresh. I actually do prefer, and this is just my personal choice, not backed by science, I actually do prefer fresh transfers. Also for the fact that the first specialist didn't want to do PGS testing. So, you know, I could fresh transfer. Whereas Lynn, my second specialist, they do prefer, especially for my age, to do PGS testing. Mm-hmm. I think we tried. So I was getting eggs and I was thankful. So at 44 and 45, in those 10 cycles I did, I collected over 145 eggs. So a lot of eggs for my particular age group.
Yeah, that's very successful.
I'll get the eggs, I'll get them matured, I'll get them fertilized. But as you know, of the, you know, the halving and the attrition rate, I'd get, you know, I would end up with so many at day 5, but then by, you know, day 6 in transfer, I might end up with 1 to transfer and none to freeze, or 1 to freeze. So it was, and that's why I had to keep doing cycles, because I had nothing banked up.
Yeah.
So yeah, the cycle that I felt pregnant at was December last year. So that was a fresh transfer as well.
Which is so interesting. They do the fresh transfers here in Canada, but they seem to, I guess, based on studies and experience over time, they do seem to lean towards the frozen transfers, because they show that success rates are slightly higher in frozen than they are versus the fresh.
So I had, I think, maybe 4 or 5 untested frozen, and after I lost the baby in February, I had them, there's a word they call TAFO, don't ask me what it stands for, but they can then try to thaw the embryos out and retest them. So I had that done because I didn't want to transfer 4 again and have 4 failures. Mm-hmm. Didn't have the time. So I was able to do that. It is expensive, but it all came back abnormal. So it you know, cleaned the slate for me pretty much. I didn't have that question mark of whether to transfer those 4 untested ones.
Yeah. So it kind of gave you some answers. And how was it for you, like, coming to the, you know, that fork in the road in, like, here's time, here's, this is what I want, and here's my options. How was it for you, like, with the donor, like, because you said you closed that chapter and weren't really open to it the year prior. So you weren't ready, right? You weren't in the place to do that. But like you said, was it as easy as like a switch flipped, or did you take the time to kind of grieve your genetics and that, you know, closing a chapter and opening another one?
It's hard to describe. It happened quickly, but it wasn't, because I already had done the work before with a psychiatrist. So I see a perinatal, postnatal women's specialist, a psychiatrist. Probably started probably a year ago. So this was a conversation we had already. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't not discussed. It wasn't not explored. But I still wasn't ready. And Sam, my psychiatrist, knew I wasn't ready. And he actually suggested that Nick come to an appointment with me after we lost the baby. It was almost 2 days after we lost the baby, which he never does. He doesn't do couples counseling. He doesn't. You know, he keeps that quite separate, but he said, let Nick come to this appointment. And I was thankful for that, because he said to Nick point blank, I think he deliberately did that. He said, he point blank said to Nick, Joanna needs to do one more cycle, whether it's for closure, but she needs to do one more cycle to grieve her genetics. And then, you know, you can move to donor, but she needs to do one more cycle for her mentally, emotionally, and physically, and for the donor child you might have in the future. Because if this, she doesn't close this chapter for her physically to do one more cycle, there may be issues down the track. So I was very appreciative he took charge and said that to Nick, because Nick was, by that stage, over it. We argued a lot about how many cycles I personally wanted to do. He was, we got 2% chance of falling pregnant at our age. What are we doing? You know, if I say you get a 98% failure rate to do something, would you do it? This is what we're doing. We're doing it, you know, over and over again with 98% chance of failure. So he's a very numerical, analytical person. So this is all he saw. Yeah. So for Sam to say that to him, and for him to say, I needed to do this more emotionally, and, you know, for me to accept and close that chapter, because it's easy for him, it's still his sperm, it's not, you know, it's not his loss. That was very, very helpful. So yes, the switch happened quickly, but there was a lot of background things that happened along the way that made the switch easy to flip.
I think too, going through something like that, it has to affect your relationship. You know, it's impossible for it to not, right?
Choosing to do donor, I think we'd work through a lot. I think our most lowest point was probably cycle 7, 8, you know, back to back, consistently stuck in that rut, going, what the hell are we doing type thing. You know, everything was, it was just a really depressive, dark, gloomy place to be in. Started seeing Sam. And then we started also seeing a couples counselor together, which helped in its own way. We instigated, like, this, you might see on my Instagram, a Friday night date night that we could do. every week at the same restaurant, the same table, that really helped us reset for the week. So even though we had the most massive fight the Friday morning, we had to show up, get dressed up for Friday night, date night, and then reset. So that really, really helped us. One thing that really got us through that really dark time.
Yeah, you need that sort of grounding thing to bring you back together. It's amazing. It's awesome that you showed up, right? Like you guys showed up together and worked on it.
Yeah, like some Fridays we'll walk into a restaurant not talking, to sit down and then. Yeah, I was okay.
By the end of it though, you're walking hand in hand.
I can totally relate too about things kind of like when they fall into place, sort of moving fast and or seeming like they're moving fast, but with background work, or also when things are right, when it's the right thing that's happening, it seems like the road just kind of opens up and unfolds very easily. You know, it doesn't feel like you're fighting the upstream all the time. It's like you're finally going with the flow of things.
I totally agree with that, because looking back how our journey unfolded in Malaysia, it wasn't easy, but it did go smoothly. Yes, there were obstacles, but we got through that obstacles without too much, you know, major stress. We had to, you know, for example, we had to extend our stay. And at that time, it was pretty much impossible to fly. Australia had caps coming in, 40 people allowed to fly in a plane in, you know, and so we had a particular return date. But then I sort of thought, no, we should really have this 6-week ultrasound before we fly back, you know, because we're going to be in 2 weeks quarantine. I'm going to have no idea what's going to happen, blah, 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 blah. Mm-hmm. We needed to extend the flight. And that was probably the most impossible thing, you know, to request at that stage. But had a good travel agent, he made it happen. You know, it seemed impossible at the time, but it happened. So, yeah, it's hard to describe. It was hard, but it wasn't.
I can totally get it for myself going through and deciding on surrogacy versus continuing to do the same thing over and over again and get the same fucking negative answer with my own body. And then all of a sudden surrogacy opened this completely different, first of all, it's a totally different world, right? Like when you're switching gears from one thing that you've been used to doing to like this new thing, it's like, oh, wow, this is a whole new world. But yeah, it just, like you said, it's not always easy and there are obstacles, but it just seems to flow better. I'm excited. Tell us about Malaysia when you arrived and kind of how that was.
It's not much to tell because they were in strict lockdown as well. So at one point we couldn't leave the house even for exercise. They had 18 to 20,000 cases a day, which is pretty high. I'm not sure what Canada was at this stage, but for Australia, I mean, we got five to 10 cases a day. We shut down. So, you know, we knew we were flying into a country that was quite, you know, COVID dangerous, I guess. So all the precautions were taken. We flew business class because you kind of have to fly business class to get there and back to get the air tickets. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So the plane had probably 20 people on the flight. Yeah, it was very surreal. We got there, we had a person greet us, meet and greet, to help us through immigration, which we were really thankful for, which the Malaysian side organized. And without her, I think we would have struggled to get through immigration, I think. Yeah, we got taken in an ambulance to the hospital that we had to quarantine in. It wasn't related to the fertility clinic, it's just because we went under a medical exemption to do IVF. They kind of deem me as needing, you know, medical help. So you have to quarantine in the hospital. So we got taken in this ambulance, you know, down this empty freeway at 120 kilometers an hour. I think the two ambulance drivers were just taking the piss, literally. It was quite a ride. And we got to this hospital and we quarantined there for 2 weeks. Nick would say it wasn't as bad as what we thought it'd be. If you ask me now how it went, I don't know what we did with our time. It's surreal. We did two lots of quarantine, Malaysia and Australia. And I can tell you now, I don't know what I did to pass the time, but we managed to pass the time and not kill each other. We actually got along really well, to be fair, 24/7 in quarantine. So that was a bonus. And when we got out, there wasn't much to see. I have family in Malaysia, so we stayed with family, which is really lucky. Mm-hmm. But we couldn't go anywhere. It was really sad. Like, Nick couldn't meet half the family I had there. I couldn't take him around as a tourist. It was a little sad that, you know, he hadn't traveled a lot. So for him not to be able to sightsee, it was a little bit disappointing. But yeah. Hopefully we'll go back again in another, you know, a few more years. He can meet my family then.
Did your family know, like, what you were doing there? Like, or why you're there in the middle of a pandemic? I just came to visit, but I can't see you.
It was weird. It was hard to explain to some. I think they knew I was going there for IVF, but I don't know to the extent of whether some of them know I was donor. All of them know I was, you know, I was there for an IVF cycle. My auntie and uncle that I stayed with obviously did. And I don't know how much the Chinese whispers worked and now everyone knows through them. But I wasn't open to all family members, but open enough to say I was there for IVF.
Gotta love family drama, eh? And the broken telephone throughout all of them.
I found being open in my journey easier than hiding it or not telling.
Less work, yeah. To some degree, I guess. Yeah.
Cool. I think it takes a really strong person to be open from, you know, the start. I find, like, for myself, it's taken many, many years to get to the sort of halfway mark and where I am in sharing publicly sort of my story and where we are and things like that. I really struggle with it. I guess just because so much pain, I've held it so close for so long that I find it difficult to share that.
I think it's different because, as you know, I've got three Instagrams, but my IVF Instagram, I'm so open. But then on my personal one, I haven't even announced my pregnancy. So yeah, it's sort of like two separate Instagrams. I mean, all my close friends know I'm pregnant and they know my story, but to share openly on my personal Instagram, I haven't yet. I will tell the journey how, when I do announce that pregnancy, this pregnancy, how hard it was, and it has been a struggle to get here, and it is IVF. But I actually don't know whether I would say it's a donor baby, so I don't know what to say. But yeah, but on my IVF one, because I've been so open from the start, it's been easy and therapeutic, actually, which is why I started in the first place, you know. It's therapy for me, so it's grown to be such a support group that I feel it's easier to share than not to share.
100%. And even I've said it many episodes before this, that I wish I had found the community sooner, because it is awesome. Like, it is unbelievable, the support that even just, like, you know, just throwing a comment to someone, or even just us getting comments back on things that we've posted, it really just makes your day, you know. And it really just, you know, okay, I'm not alone in this shit journey that sometimes we think we are really alone in.
Absolutely.
Joanna, can we go back to when you looked at when you found out you were pregnant this time, like your emotions, how you were feeling?
Oh, it was, it was surreal. The transfer and the 2-week wait, it's the same as any other 2-week wait. I didn't really feel anything. You know how some people get implantation bleeding, cramps? I think I got some cramps, but it wasn't anything that I got excited about. I just honestly had faith that this was my answer. In my heart of hearts, like, I could not believe, I couldn't accept that I chose this path and this transfer wouldn't work for me. So I really believed and prayed that, you know, yep, first go, donor cycle is going to work. I had so many people tell me, don't expect the first one to work as well. I'm like, what do you mean? Don't expect the first time. I can't do this again and again and again. But I really had faith that my oven was okay and I just needed the right embryo. So, yeah, I actually peed on a stick. It must have been 4 a.m. I got up and it was day 8 and I peed on a stick and it was so hot in Malaysia. Everything's air conditioned, but the bathroom was just steaming hot. And I remember peeing on the stick and those two pink lines came up so clearly. I was crying on the toilet. and I had to sneak in not to wake my auntie and uncle, and sneak into bed not to wake Nick. She's like waiting. Should I tell him? Should I not tell him? So I had to wait another 2 hours. So we got up and then, yeah, I showed him the stick when he was half asleep. And yeah, so it was happy days. It was tears of joy.
Oh yeah.
And I was lucky enough to get a very high HCG. I can't remember exactly. I think it was 600s, 800s, whatever. That first one was super high. It wasn't some, you know, number that was under 100 that was iffy. So yeah. It was strong, it was high. And then it was in the thousands by my second one. So yeah, it was a relief, put it that way.
Oh. It had burrowed its way in really, really good.
Yeah, and then obviously I kept peeing on the stick, and it was by day 10, like a die stealer, as you know the term. So it was really strong line. So, yes, then it was just a matter of fact of getting that travel extension so we could get to that six-week scan literally the day before we flew. So, yeah, the confirmation to see that, to hear and see the embryo and the heartbeat was, yeah, it was just amazing. And I'm so grateful we did that before we flew back.
When did you do that test? Like, did you do it close to when you had your beta, or did you do it kind of earlier?
Beta was day 10. So I peed on the stick day 8.
Oh, day 8.
I probably should have waited day 9. I usually pee the day before, but like I couldn't. Yeah. It was day 8. So 2 days before. But at that stage, I knew if it was negative on day 8, it's negative. So it wasn't like I peed on day 6 where it still could be a positive, and it still wasn't a mind fuck if it wasn't. Mm-hmm. So I knew day 8, if it wasn't there, it wasn't there. Let's move on to plan B. So it was more me being, you know, the control freak. Let's plan. Do I need to stay for another 3 months?
Oh, I totally get it. I did the exact same. I did some cycles where, you know, you start peeing the moment after you have sex, basically. At the beginning, it's ridiculous how early you test, right? And then, some of them after transfer, I'd wait. And then towards, you know, the end, when you start getting into transfer 5, 6, and 7, when you're a pro all of a sudden, it's like, I'm going to wait just a little bit closer. And then you know you have that kind of definitive, that feeling, right? You just know when it didn't work.
Right.
Yeah. My kicker, you know what my kicker was? Watching you go through. So like, you know, we joined kind of the tail end of your journey. The kicker was at the end with your clinic with the bell.
The bell.
Oh my God. Oh my God.
Every the clinic tears. Should have that.
Yeah. Do you want to talk about that moment?
That was special. I know it was special embarrassing because you're there and then everyone can hear you. Then everyone just, whoever is in the waiting room at the time just stands up and claps for you. So, yeah, it was really nice. It was really nice. We actually did it twice because the clinic wanted to video it for their own little thing that they had. So we did it twice. So it was surreal. Like Nick said, he said to me the other day, because my bump was obviously growing, he goes, "This is real now." He goes, "You know, ringing the bell, that first ultrasound, it wasn't real for him." He goes, "This is real now when I see your bump." But I said, "No, the bell was special. The bell was very special." Because that was our aim. That's the first thing we saw when we walked through that clinic. Yeah. I've got to ring that bell. I've got to ring that bell in, you know, whatever, 3 weeks.
That ringing the bell symbolizes such like good things, like last people's chemo, last people's radiation. It could just, yes. I actually told my husband, I want a bell in our home. So anytime we have good news, we'll just ring it.
Well, yeah, Em, you guys totally know that feeling, right?
Yeah, last chemo ringing it. And then at the hospital, it was like a big gong that he rang for radiation. But he didn't want the attention. But I'm like, no, I have to video and record it. It really, truly is something so special. Can't describe it. But yeah, I'm so happy you got to ring it.
It's a small thing, but it's so significant. The sound, the action. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's like it's a physical reminder that like, hey, we fucking did it. Mm-hmm. We did it. Like, let's share with everyone that we reached this milestone, right? Yeah, I think you're right. I think all fertility clinics should have a big bill.
Yeah.
That'd be awesome.
We need some good cheer. it's quite depressing in some of the clinic, well, most of the clinics, most of the time. So to have a little cheer wouldn't help, wouldn't be bad.
I mean, that clinic was beautiful. If you'd followed me, you'd see how beautiful that clinic was, is. Yeah. My clinic in Melbourne, the one that I left, she, Lynn, is amazing as well. Her clinic is spa-like. It's called the Pink Palace, and the transfer facility is called the Emerald City, and it, she makes it beautiful. But the clinic before, the two big other clinics here, they very sterile. You know, the transfer room was white walls, basically a white sterile hospital room. So it's just very unpleasant. So, mm-hmm. I mean, the more you can make it an experience, mm-hmm. somewhere you want to be,
yeah,
it's so much more pleasant. Like, we actually want to go to the clinic because it's so nice.
Yeah, we do not. Well, at least in my experience,
no.
With the few that I've been to, we do not have
no.
That.
Yeah. My first clinic, same thing, didn't want to be there. It was just gross.
And it's just like, it's also busy. Is it busy in the clinics as well in Australia? Like, when we're in the waiting room, it's like full of women.
Mm-hmm. Not now because of COVID, so right. They're practicing safe, you know, appointments, sort of waiting in the car, and they're staggering a lot of appointments. But beforehand, yeah, there'll be, you know, for scans and day 5 scans, day 7 scans, the waiting rooms are pretty full.
Yeah. So you think all of these poor women who are in our, you know, in our situation, in our boats, they probably all feel the same way. That cold, you know, not homey like atmosphere, place we don't want to be.
Mm-mm. Yes.
Is there something that you would really like to say to, or, you know, a piece of advice you'd like to offer to someone who may be going through a similar situation?
I would say, like what we all did, to find your tribe, which I did create on my Instagram. It's called IVF Tribe. But I would really, I mean, you don't have to be open. You don't have to be on social media. Just find a few friends that you can sort of really talk to. I think that really helps you on your way. Because I find so many women who reach out or who comment on my story or whatever it is, you know, they say, I've told no one that I'm going through this. You know, it's my 5th loss or my 10th cycle. And they've told no one. But then they've just messaged this random stranger on the internet to tell them their story. So I think, yeah, everyone just needs that one or two friends in their corner they can just physically actually just share, you know, what they're going through. I really honestly think that's important. If they can't find that person, I'd highly recommend just seeking a psychiatrist or a psychologist that specializes in infertility, women's health. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I cannot more highly recommend that.
This journey is so lonely and isolating at times that, yeah, I think it's so important to talk to, even if it's, like you said, just one person, just talk to someone, paid or unpaid.
I know.
Doesn't matter.
The other thing I would probably advise a lot of women is to sort of advocate for themselves, because before I started researching, before I started joining Facebook forums, I had no idea. I had no idea all these tests I could have, all these things I should request, you know, not just go with the flow and just having, you know, XYZ medication when there was XYZ, ABCDEFG things I could have. So, you know, do your research, advocate for yourself. If your specialist is not listening to you, find another one that will listen to you. Find another one that really hears you. Mm-hmm. That would be my advice.
Because
not all clinics are the same, unfortunately.
Yeah. I think we go into the situation not knowing much about this area, and we tend to follow along blindly with what our physicians recommend because we don't know any better.
And we pay them. And we pay them a lot of money.
Yeah.
Yeah,
we expect an outcome too with all that money.
I know, and unfortunately some people don't get that outcome and they've forked out hundreds and thousands of dollars. So yeah, my advice is definitely advocate for yourself in as much as you can.
Yeah, that's huge. That is huge. Definitely. Well, Joanna, we can't thank you enough for being on our podcast episode today. It has been an absolute pleasure chatting with you, and we commend you for being so brave and posting your stories online. And I'm so looking forward to continue to follow your journey and see everything as it unfolds. It has been great. And even just to watch your strength over the last few months and what you've gone through to get to where you are now, it's so inspiring to know that, you know, you kind of keep at it, keep going, and you can achieve, you know, anything that you kind of, you know, keep trudging through the shitstorm that some of us are, you know, we're in. But it has been great, and we really look forward to seeing you, our end of the journey.
Well, yes, I can't wait for March 2022 to meet this little one. So hopefully I will get there. All I'm praying for right now is the most boring, uncomplicated, uneventful pregnancy ever. Don't care. Want a boring pregnancy? No dramas. Just get me to March 2022 when I can meet my little baby.
Absolutely. Yeah. Our thoughts and prayers are with you to have the most boring and uneventful pregnancy. And remember, everyone, in any project, including the baby project, you must take things one step at a time.
Got a question for us? Or perhaps you would like to share your story and be a guest on our podcast? Feel free to connect with us by emailing us at thebabyproject_@outlook.com or DM us on Instagram @thebabyproject_. Thanks for listening.